Fight Week on the Opening Bell podcast with me, Alex Steegman, and Matt Christie as we count down to the latest installment, the latest chapter in the boxing life. No life without boxing for Canelo, of course, as he takes on Yildirim. We'll reflect on an eventful weekend of boxing where David Avanesian overcame Josh Kelly. Gavin Gwynn did likewise for a Commonwealth title against Sean McComb. And Oscar Valdez was close to brilliant against Miguel Barchelt. More surprises and mini upsets to reflect on. Any time we've got a big fight and fight week to look forward to. It's a great week. Matt Christie, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. I was delighted with the news on Monday evening that my daughter, who I adore more than anything else on this planet, will be going back to school in a couple of weeks' time. So yeah, celebration time, I think. It's been a hectic few months. A rewarding few months, but yeah, very, very hectic.
And the big news this week, outside of the boxing world, is that M.D. Christie, Matt Christie, is getting a puppy. And the brand new puppy will enter Christie Towers this weekend.
Yep.
As we count down to Canelo. There were a raft of boxing-related names that were on the table, on the menu, or simply just on your list. Who's the winner?
Well, do you know what? I was really, really... I mean, my personal favourite was Smoking Bert Christie.
Terrific.
But I couldn't... Yeah, you know, I tried to put the case forward, but my daughter wasn't keen. My wife wasn't keen on Smoking Bert.
That's democracy in action.
But they said, well, we'll consider Bertie. I was like, whoa. No. Not Bertie.
You can't be down the park when there's like an Alsatian over the other side and be saying, Bertie, come hither, Bertie. You can't be doing that, can you?
No, but I have managed to get Rocky over the line. So, yeah, pleased with that as well. Little Jack Russell, who is currently very close to being 8 weeks old. I think it's the last of... the injections he's got to have, and then we pick him up on Saturday morning. And I was watching Dogs Behaving Badly last night on Channel 5, and there was this psychotic Jack Russell on there that was just biting anything that went near him. So as long as he grows up to be a bit like that, then yeah, brilliant. But no, Rocky. sincerely looking forward to it. Really looking
forward
great.
To That's it. That's a great addition to the fact. And Rocky it is. Smoking Bert Cooper. Bert would have been good. Coops would have been good. Smoking, I think, would have been great. And when you think back, actually, have dog names changed in the last two or three decades? When I was a kid growing up, it seemed every dog was called Rambo or, you know, Ruthless. Or there was always some sort of Terminator-like name for dogs. They seem to have softened in subsequent decades, it seems. Let's move on, Matt. Just before we press on with all that's coming up and all that has, I was commentating last Friday night, and we're going to talk briefly on Gavin Gwynn's fantastic performance beating Sean McComb. Stylistically, a very similar story to Avanesian overcoming Kelly, and we'll reflect on all of that. But I did just spend 5 minutes before the fights because I wanted to speak to Howard Foster. I wanted to just pose a few questions to a few refs, but I actually spoke to Howard Foster. Obviously, and I didn't go into talking about Warrington and the stoppage and such like, but at some stage I will ask other questions to Howard Foster, but I just wanted to ask him about, you know, being a ref in the modern day, and particularly with social media and the kind of Twitter frenzy that we often see unleashed on Saturday nights particularly. And I wanted to ask him just how that had sort of impacted upon his life. And he was telling me, particularly in the aftermath of Frotch Groves 1, some of the stuff that he had to put up with was ridiculous. Now, I don't know if I'd heard about that or I'd just forgotten about it or whether I'd brushed it under the carpet. I don't know. But he was telling me at the weekend that he was having windows in his home smashed after that. What what sort of people are going to a man's home in reaction to something that might have happened days or weeks or months after? I came away from that discussion really, really angry. No matter how you feel about the way a fight has unfolded, whether you had a bet on it or not, and that's another debate I could go into as someone who likes a bet. You know, if you have a bet, you have to assume responsibility for placing that bet. But anyway, that's another discussion. But no matter how passionately and how much you disagree about the rights or wrongs of a situation like that or any other, or those that we've seen in recent weeks, I believe Terry O'Connor's had similar sort of family treatment as well. But windows in your family home smashed because of something that happened in the sporting sphere. I was so angry, Matt, when I heard that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember hearing about what Howard went through back then, and it's unforgivable. I mean, completely moronic behaviour. And yeah, I mean, we can all kind of watch a fight and disagree with the decision, but to go that far with it, there's no excuse whatsoever for it. And you do kind of wonder if by kind of fanning that flame, by getting involved on social media on a Saturday night, you're also part of the problem. It's made me think recently as well. It has made me think how you know, someone as the editor of Boxing News reacts to these things, whether or not, you know, I agree with them or not. Sometimes I think it's necessary for the editor of Boxing News to make a comment. But often, perhaps, it's not that helpful. It's not that helpful. And I just think, you know, we all make calls at work. We all make decisions at work. Not all of them are right. And there's nobody out there that doesn't make mistakes or doesn't make a call that some colleagues or some people in our industry don't agree with. It's part and parcel of life. We can have an opinion on whether or not an official got a decision right or wrong, but to take it any further than that, I think is absolutely disgusting.
Sport compels passion, doesn't it? And almost fanaticism, I think it's fair to say. And that is one of its beauties. There's no doubt about that. But when you're crossing lines and boundaries like that, then you really have to ask yourself some serious questions, or some serious questions need to be asked of you. And I'm hoping that in saying that, I'm not actually talking to any of our listeners who go anywhere remotely near that kind of a line. And it's not even a borderline. It's just a line that shouldn't be crossed.
Absolutely. And I think something that came to my mind, and I made a note of it on Saturday night. Now, you know, I don't want to go back down the old ground again, but something that has occurred to me in regard to the officials is that we don't really know them. I know the likes of you and I will have conversations with them when we're at ringside and what have you. But I just wondered, and perhaps it's a conversation I'll have with Robert Smith, if there's something we can do in regard to something along the lines of meet the officials, whether we do that in Boxing News, whether we do it on here. We don't necessarily have to grill the officials about certain decisions, but perhaps let's just get to know them a little bit more. It's almost like they've been dehumanized a little bit, because we don't hear it. They're just these figures that operate at ringside. They make the calls that people agree with or don't agree with. Yet people often forget, I think, that these are human beings. These are human beings with families who care deeply about the sport. And I think all that is forgotten. I think all that is forgotten, that we don't take into consideration their feelings when we criticise so poisonously.
That is the something I suppose we can look into. And actually, it did sort of raise other questions to me, as Matt said, about how we deal with things personally, how we interact on Twitter, how we feel about certain fighters, officials, etc. And we're going to discuss that in a little detail in relation to some of the results of last week. And most notable, of course, was David Avanesian's victory over Josh Kelly in six rounds, defending his European title for the third time. And very much like the Gavin Gwynn victory over Sean McComb, the night before. And this is without denigrating the skill levels that the victor showed in both of those fights. But it really did feel like there was a large element of will over skill, of experience perhaps over inexperience, mental fortitude to an extent over perhaps something slightly less. And we'll go into that in a little more detail. It seemed to me, Matt, that Avanesian was willing and prepared to lose early rounds to get himself into a position where he might be able to win the fight. Now, I think he probably couldn't believe that he was able to get so close, maybe in the fifth round and then the sixth particularly, and then how rapidly things swirled in his favour from having got close to getting very close to making an impact, to turning the fight, to winning the fight. It all unravelled very, very quickly for Josh Kelly, having looked pretty good in the early going.
Yeah, I was surprised with how quickly it did unravel for Josh Kelly, to be honest with you. I think we made the comment last week about that we kind of half-fancied Avanesian to kind of do the business. It was no secret from Carl Greaves that they were willing to give away those early rounds because they knew that their man would come on strong. And I think the word that you use there, and it's a crucial one in boxing, is experience. With both Gwynn and with Avanesian, they'd both lost before. They knew how to lose. They they knew how to come back from that. And I think that was that really was the crucial component in both victories. David Avanesian now, I think he's what I found interesting going back to Josh Kelly, is that I was watching fights of Sky Sports as they do in the build up to the live event at the weekend. They were replaying certain fights from their back catalogue, from the Josh Kelly back catalogue, when he was on his way up and he was looking sensational. And you could see Adam Booth in the background. There was some comment there that back in 2018, 2017, 2018, that they would be willing to take on Kell Brook. They'd be willing to take on Amir Khan. And that was kind of the trajectory for Josh Kelly that was always in place. Now, I think we can also look at when this fight was first supposed to take place at the end of December 2018, and what has happened since. And Avanesian's career, which was kind of stuttering at that point, has gone from strength to strength with what he was doing in Spain, winning and defending the European title. Whereas Josh Kelly, who prior to that was full of self-belief, then went on and had two rather tricky fights, one in America against Ray Robinson, where you can say he was quite fortunate to get the decision. So mentally, and we know that Josh Kelly is a huge deep thinker, and I think mentally it was just too much of a mountain to climb. It may not have been when he heard the opening bell ring, but when he'd been fairly impressive during the first four rounds and not really put a dent in Avanesian. Then when Avanesian came on strong, he will know that will have been the tactics. And, you know, it all came apart for him. Now, I'm not saying that he quit or anything like that. He was gutsy to the end. I thought Adam Booth's intervention was perfect. Exactly the right thing to do to save Josh Kelly for another day. And it made me think, and I know the comparison has been made since by various people in boxing, but it immediately made me think back to what Adam Booth, as I've heard him talk to Tris Dixon about this on Tris Dixon's podcast, I've heard him talk to Mike Costello and Steve Bunce as well about it, in that one of his biggest regrets was not pulling David Haye out earlier against Carl Thompson. And at the precise moment that he felt in his head that this Josh Kelly couldn't win the fight, in came the towel. I thought that was perfect. And I think ultimately, there's probably too much discussion about whether it came too soon for Josh Kelly, whether or not, you know, he can come back from this. Of course he can. Of course he can come back from this. It wasn't a six-round hammering where he was thumped from pillar to post. I really think he can come back from this if he can learn the lessons. And just, you know, there is this culture in boxing where every fighter, if they're going to go on to win a world title, have to remain unbeaten. But there are so many valuable lessons to be learned in fights like this. There's no shame in losing a European title fight at this point.
There was a really good line from journalist writer Mark Butcher on Twitter, which I thought kind of summed up the nuance of the question that you've just partly answered and partly posed, because they go together in the same sentence. And Mark said, a step too soon rather than a step too far. I've slightly paraphrased what he said, but a step too soon or a step too far, question mark, essentially. And you're feeling that that's a step too soon. The one thing I would say about that and the comparison with Haig against Carl Thompson, it's an obvious one, would be twofold. One, that kind of the fast twitch style of Josh Kelly, which is essentially an Adam Booth style, isn't it? That's how Adam Booth likes his, he likes his fighters to be fast twitch and explosive. Is that always going to be the kind of style for someone like Kelly that uses up too much energy, mental, nervous, or just physical? So that would be one sort of slight question mark. Again, just wondering aloud. And the other would be the fact that it all unraveled so very, very quickly. And does that perhaps just hint at something else? And that probably is maybe more on the mental side. And that is a very difficult question to pose.
Yeah, it absolutely is. You can look back at Josh Kelly as an amateur, and when he looked good, he looked sensational. When he didn't, you're kind of wondering if it was the same fighter. And I've seen it, and going back to that Ray Robinson fight, where things were going his way early on, but when they were not, there was that real struggle to turn it back around. And that is more of a mental thing than a physical thing, or a question mark over his skill set. And that's what he'll have to address. And he may never address it, or he may never be able to. Not every fighter can. How many fighters have you heard where they'll say, you know, 95% of this boxing game is mental? You know, how many times have we heard that? Not everybody is lucky enough or blessed with that incredible mental strength that you need to get to the very top in the sport of boxing.
And of course we are exploring other avenues. It might seem to some like we're nitpicking, and I don't think I said it on last week's pod, but I definitely said it in conversation when I was ringside on Friday to someone else. Actually, it was in conversation with Spencer Fearon, and he asked me, you know, how did I see the fight going, and I said then, and it's something I should have said or would have said had we explored it more last week, I commentated on Kelly in the amateurs. I was in Doha in 2015 when he fought there. Now, you'd be a very, very hard man or woman to criticise him too much for the fact that he lost in both of those tournaments, in 2015, the World Championships, and in Rio in 2016 as well. He lost on both occasions the eventual winner, the eventual gold medalist of the tournaments. But I must admit, when I called his fight in Doha, and that was against a Moroccan called Mohamed Rabi, terrific fighter who's got a pro style and is already unbeaten. I think he's 10 or 11, I know, as a pro. Rabi was one of the finds of the tournament for me 5-6 years ago. But I must admit, I came away from that fight thinking that Kelly could have done more and didn't. And why couldn't he or wouldn't he was the question I came away thinking and just wondering. And that was always in my notebook, that it would be something that I would return to throughout the pro ranks. And we've not really seen it tested properly until Saturday night. Now, as I say, hands up, that might have been a red herring, and it might still be to an extent, but it was just something that was on the card that I just had to watch and monitor. And I wondered it going into to Saturday doesn't mean we got conclusive proof that that's the case, but you've just, there's another thing that maybe just adds up, and we'll have to see. But listen, obviously Adam Booth believes in him, that the sort of the gym and inspiring stories are otherworldly, but what we've seen so far in the ring hasn't quite justified the hype. But Matt, in saying all of that, we should take nothing away from the way David Avanesian performed, went about it. And one thing that struck me on the back of that performance was they were supposed to fight a couple of years ago, on, off. But the prevailing wisdom, Matt, was that, you know, Avanesian might have been way too much 2 years ago for Kelly, but now Kelly having the time to improve and develop, that maybe he was going to be too much for Avanesian. And that underpins and underplays the fact that Avanesian is probably by far and away a better fighter himself than he was several years ago.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to look at that fight as well. But I mean, when they started talking about the fight initially, Josh Kelly had been completely faultless. He had those two fights, Ray Robinson, Wiston Campos, where they were quite tough bouts. Robinson won in particular, and then he hadn't had a fight for 14 months. So he's not going into this fight with a great deal of confidence, you can imagine. Whereas the opposite is true of Avanesian. But Avanesian has been a tremendous fighter for a long time. He's been overlooked, he's been underrated. And I just hope now that at the age of 32 that he does get the kind of fights that he deserves. I mean, it's perhaps a stretch to say that after beating Josh Kelly, who, if we're going to be honest, is an unproven, if highly thought of, prospect, he then gets a world title shot. But you mix that in with the performances against Liraga and what have you, and you can say that he well deserves his spot in the top 10 and therefore deserves to test himself against one of the champions. That, moving on to the top of the welterweight division with your Spences and your Crawfords, etc. It's a heck of an ask for him. But what we have seen with Avanesian is what an education can do for you. And that education isn't just how you're trained in the gym. It's what is kind of the journey you take throughout your career. And he has experienced defeat in the past and come back from it. He's been with some good names in the past and he's come back for it. And now I think he's better than he's ever been as a consequence. So perhaps the best source of inspiration for Josh Kelly when he dusts off his gloves and decides to get back in the ring and start training again is the man that's just beaten him.
And he's only 26 and he'd only had relatively a handful of fights going into that. So way too soon to be talking about the future or indeed writing off Josh Kelly here and now. Just a dozen fights into his career, that first defeat, hopefully that's going to be a platform rather than a hindrance. We will learn about that further down the line. And 24 hours previously, we perhaps had a forewarning and a taster of this when I commentated on Gavin Gwynn's victory over Sean McComb for the Commonwealth title, that lightweight belt, vacant one. Gwynn, of course, who'd fought for it before when he lost over 12 to Joe Cardina, and then he'd lost in 6 to Tennyson as well, who, you know, is a world-class puncher, Tennyson, and had fought for a world title as well. It was another terrific fight. McComb was winning the early rounds, but he was being forced to fight at a pace you could see, Matt, that he wasn't comfortable with. And in the end, Gwynn was simply too much to him. And you could see McComb, he was cut over both eyes. He was hurt with a body shot, I think in about the third or the fourth round as well. And eventually he turned his back and waved the fight off himself, waved off the referee in the seventh round. So it was a fairly dramatic turnaround, but there was a feeling of inevitability about the way Gwynn was picking up a head of steam.
You could see it kind of developing in the same way you could see the fight 24 hours later developing, in that the favourite, the prospect, was winning the early rounds, but not winning them in a way that you felt he was then going to go on to win the fight. And that was the difference in both of them. I mean, with fights like this, they're always a gamble, aren't they? They're always a massive, massive gamble to write off the opponent. And you have to do that to an extent when you make these fights, to write off the ambition of the older and more experienced man. And in both cases, I'm sorry, it was experience more than anything that won the day.
Yeah, I think toughness, perseverance, and I think the willingness just to go to that dark, painful place. I think that was crucial too. And Gwyn, he was so emotional afterwards, and he said to me when I interviewed him afterwards that he had been prepared to do whatever it took to win on that night. And you could see that in the performance, and there's no doubt that played a huge role in it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that kind of does come from experience of, you know, I'm not when I say they know how to lose, I suppose a better way of saying it is they know how it felt afterwards. They know how, I mean, you can't understate the dark places that boxers go to, not only in the ring, but they get even darker and difficult to emerge from in the immediate aftermath of a defeat. And Gwyn had experienced that. Avanesyan had experienced that. That can drive them on and create that toughness in a funny sort of a way.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. That is a good point. Because like anything in fighters, you know, they learn to go 4 rounds, 6 rounds, 8 rounds, 10 rounds, 12 rounds. And you're constantly ticking those boxes as you go. And getting hurt, being put down, those are other boxes. Those are other places you need to visit. And you don't really know how you react until that's happened. So I think that's a good point. The big difficulty, I think, for Macomb, and it's worth mentioning, that he'll probably take solace in the fact that he'd had a sort of long, interrupted preparation. It was his first time at 135 pounds, but I don't necessarily think that was the sole reason. But he'd been out to Pakistan, he'd been out to Dubai, the fight was supposed to be on before, it had kind of dragged out and dragged out, and he'd been here, there and everywhere. And it may be part of it was that he'd been in camp too long and that, you know, around the world. But one thing he did say, and this was a tweet that Macomb put out himself, he said afterwards, during the fight, that I realised I've got a child in the house while I was getting battered. It's not about me anymore, he said. And he's just had a newborn baby with his partner. And, you know, almost in that moment in the fight, he was conscious of the danger he was in and the impact that would have on his new and extended family. So, I mean, that's a very honest thing to reveal. It does put him in a difficult position mentally, I think, going forward, because that situation is always going to be there, isn't it? Unless you just say it's only because he has a newborn baby that it was more prescient and it was more significant. So that's something that he'll have to deal with, and good luck to him, because I think he probably got lots of criticism. And that leads on to the discussion of criticism, and also, and this relates to a really good article that Terry Dooley wrote on the Boxing News Online website this week. So go look at that if you can, please. Terry Dooley's article, and it's on Schadenfreude. Yes, we're not going back to university, folks, and we're not taking up German lessons. It's Schadenfreude. And basically, Schadenfreude means to take pleasure in the misfortunes of others, essentially. And there was a lot of that around over the weekend, I think it's fair to say. And it's not a new phenomenon. It's been swirling around for a few years. But I think there was a lot of people, plenty of people, enjoying, if not reveling in the defeat of Josh Kelly, and they probably line up Adam Booth in the crossfire along with that as well. McComb probably got some of it to a lesser extent as well. But because of Kelly and Adam Booth's profile, I suspect more of that vitriol and that enjoyment in their misfortune. And Terry discusses that in his article. It really is a good read. And it kind of links back to, I suppose, one of the first times, Matt, I might have been aware of it in the boxing sense, might have been Audley Harrison and his career a couple of times. The loss to David Hay got it particularly for the manner of the defeat. I remember the spectacular knockout when he lost to Michael Sprott, that the crowd reaction that night was a most painfully expressive version of Schadenfreude perhaps you'll ever see and hear, I think, at a boxing ring, an event. Probably Amir Khan got a load of it as well, although I suspect there was a bit of racism mixed into that. And I think latterly, probably Anthony Joshua after his defeat to Ruiz. So it's not a new phenomenon, but it does seem to be swirling around boxing these days. And Terry's sort of links that to the internet era, but particularly the evolution of Twitter.
Yeah, special mention for Terry, really. I mean, he provides top-class content. I mean, it can be sometimes a bit difficult to get him motivated to do things, but when he's on board with the subject, he's certainly on board with it, and he will absolutely, he will go to town on it. And this is something that he and I had talked about in the past. And, yeah, I mean, I think even you know, go back a little bit further than that, and I'm sure it would be throughout history. I mean, when Muhammad Ali came along, people despised Muhammad Ali because he was so sure of himself. And I think the way that people present themselves, and that is, you know, people can almost take offence at another person's confidence. But it's not an exact science, as Terry explores, in that some people seem to take pleasure when David Price's career took a nosedive. Whereas David Price is one of the nicest and most humble people you could ever wish to meet. It's almost like, I suppose, the kind of football terrace mentality where you so desperately want one team to win and the other team to lose. But I've experienced it many times. And I think the worst one that I can remember when I was actually at ringside again is an Audley Harrison. And it was against David Price. It was at the Echo Arena. And David Price walked through Audley Harrison. And Audley Harrison was in a terrible state on the canvas after taking a pasting. And the noise, the euphoria in that arena because Audley Harrison. And it wasn't just because David Price had won. It wasn't. It was because he had just smeared Audley Harrison all over the canvas. And I found that deeply, deeply distasteful. And again, there's been many times where I've been at boxing where I've questioned, really questioned. I think anybody that works in the industry, anybody that goes to fights regularly, watches it, will champion the sport, will often question that adoration for the sport at the same time. And it was one of those moments. I was like, what am I doing? You've just got thousands and thousands of people cheering, rampant mad cheering because someone is getting medical attention on the canvas. That's it's really interesting. But I can understand it to a lesser degree when people are not so passionate about it. I mean, for example, we've just finished it, the Desert Island fights, where we were naming the favourite fight from each decade. And there was a couple of votes for Marco Antonio Barrera versus Nassim Hamed. That's not because it was a great fight. That's because they want to go off to the desert island and sit there and revel in Nassim Hamed losing. I've no doubt about it. It's a very, very, very odd mindset. But as Terry identifies in the article, we're all human, and I'm sure we can all identify with it, even if it's only to the smallest degree. But the extent that it goes to is astonishing.
I suppose, as you say, how you portray yourself, how you carry yourself, the image that you've built up for yourself. That can often be factored into it. You talked about Ali, as might even have happened, I suppose, around Jack Johnson's time to an extent as well. And Nassim Hamid, you touched on it as well. Is that, in a sense, is that a very British mood and philosophy about wanting to see the cocky guy, or maybe these days girl as well, man or woman, being upstage, being brought down a peg or two? Is there a very British sentiment in all of that, do you think?
I think an element of it is, I mean, you know, I you know, one of my favorite characteristics in anybody is humility. And I admire genuine humility in the successful. But is it solely a British trait? No. I mean, you just look at, for example, the Floyd Mayweather era. And from being at many of Floyd Mayweather's fights, particularly the later ones, is that when he said that a lot of the people are buying tickets to see me lose, or to hopefully to see me lose, he was right. He was right. He would get booed at the weigh-in the day before. Many times his opponent, even though he was fighting in his backyard, many times his opponent was the crowd favourite. So I think the people that shout and scream about how wonderful they are and roll around in their beds of dollar bills and what have you, or you've got people like Adrian Broner in a strip club flushing them down the toilet, which is one of the most obnoxious acts, I think, that one can do, particularly in the world that we all live in where so many people struggle. I think it's not really a surprise when Adrian Broner and people like that lose, and you have a little smile on your face about it, or one, I should say, has a little smile on their face about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's Broner's at one end of the spectrum of this as a discussion, and you know, someone like Josh Kelly's at the other end of the discussion. I think it's fair
completely.
To say what one thing that surprises me a little, because it is, you know, often in sport, you're backing your man or women, your team, your city, your country. It kind of goes up in different levels. And so something like, you know, AJ Fury, you're either team AJ or team Fury. I get that, definitely. And supporting your man. It might be Leeds against Liverpool, or Manchester against Leeds, or Manchester Liverpool, or Scottish English. I get all of that. When it perhaps ceases to make less sense is when you've got a British or Irish fighter taking on international competition and Schadenfreude still comes into play. That's when, Matt, is perhaps a little more difficult to explain, to reason, or maybe to understand.
I think the bottom line, really, well, not the bottom line, but ultimately, as I've said, as I've said to my friends in the past, I say to my daughter, we ultimately, as human beings, will judge fellow human beings by our own standards. So this whole concept and this level of hatred towards people that we don't know is largely alien to the likes of you and me, because we're better than that. You know, we have more respect for human beings than that. Whereas when I see this level of when I see this, and you see it in stadiums, but I think the worst place for it is on social media. Again, Terry kind of goes into that. And I see that what some of the fighters and the people in any industry are subjected to, it just absolutely makes my mind boggle. Who does this? Who on earth takes such pleasure in doing this?
I remember, I mean, when I used to be a football fan, less so these days. I've always sort of liked football, used to play it a lot. And I was a kind of home and away Hearts fan back in the day when I was sort of 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. And one of the beauties of going to the football, and it definitely was for those generations who were older than me at that time, was that, you know, Saturday was the day where you went to the football and you could let off some steam. You literally were going to have a few pints. You'd have a shout and a swear. Some people might take it more than that, but that was essentially it. And I suppose maybe there's an element of that release, is there, that now we see focused elsewhere, and somewhere like Twitter is perhaps a very, very extreme a platform for that releasing of steam. But anyway, let's concentrate on something that really did blow us away, and getting back to on point about how amazing this sport can be, and that is Oscar Valdez and his performance last weekend against Miguel Burchelt. Both you and I last weekend thought Burchelt would be too strong, too good, and too big for Valdez. How wrong could we be? It was a rather dominant performance all the way through from Valdez, who had Burchelt down and in trouble in the fourth, in the eighth, and then in the ninth as well. It was a commanding performance, particularly and laterally on the back foot as well. How surprised were you with what it was that Valdez brought to the table and how significant his performance was?
Yeah, I seriously underrated Valdez going in to the fight. I didn't think he was capable of a complete performance like that. They're the kind of performances that signal your arrival as a genuine boxing superstar. It was that good a performance in my eyes. I mean, the one bit of criticism perhaps would be the manner of his celebration at the end, where Burchelt was clearly in a bad way and Valdez took a leap over him into the air in celebration. But you can understand it. He wasn't the favourite. He'd been written off. I mean, their rivalry, though, you wouldn't call it a grudge rivalry, but it goes back. It does go back a long way. And but aside from that, I thought Valdez was superb. I mean, the finishing punch is going to, you know, that's the leader for knockout of the year already. And a nod as well to the Eddie Reynoso camp, which is absolutely flying, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely right. Funnily enough, the first round or two, I was thinking, wow, A-up, they've turned him into a super featherweight Canelo, because he was on the front foot, he was coming forward with that high guard, there was upper body movement, and I thought, my goodness me. And then he spent the rest of the fight on the back foot. Through the middle rounds, I thought he was being forced back rather than choosing to go back. But then laterally down the stretch, where he took command of the fight again, he was definitely on the back foot through choice, and he was setting up the shots. He could not miss with a left hook. If you're going to face Valdez going forward, like I've said on the pod before about Bernard Hopkins in his day, would say, what's my opponent's best weapon and how do I take that away? And he would look at Valdez and he'd say, right, it's the left hook. His right hand is nothing compared to his left, particularly the left hook. Still winds up his punches quite a lot, but he gets away with it through sheer hand speed. And it is. And he winds his punches up so much and they are so fast that the power is just terrific for a super featherweight. But, you know, there's no doubt Hopkins would look to take away his left hook. I'm no tactician. How he'd do that, I'm not quite sure. I imagine he might be circling in one direction rather than another to slightly offset the power from that shot. But he could not miss with a left hook. And despite several warnings, Burchelt kept walking into it. And finally, he was stopped. So you couldn't call it a break out or breakthrough performance by Valdez, because we know plenty about him, but there was something else, and you have to feel that it's the Reynoso, Canelo, Ryan Martin camp feel and tactical work that they've been doing has come to bear in all of that. He looked much more the finished article.
And it can be so contagious, that winning feeling, can't it? you know, given what, you know, what Canelo has done over the last couple of years, in that he's kind of cemented his place as the sport's leading star. Ryan Garcia came through, you know, what many deemed a 50-50 fight against Luke Campbell. And then all that will be feeding into Valdez. And I think that, no, you know, I hear what you're saying, but he just ticks so many more boxes than he normally does. And I think it may have been the fact that he was fighting Bichel that allowed him to tick those boxes. But kind of going back to the training camp thing, we've seen it with lots of camps in the past, haven't we? We, you know, even on these shores, we think, remember when the Enzo Calzaghe camp was up and running, and every fighter that Enzo Calzaghe touched seemed to go from kind of sort of someone at British level to then winning a world title. And we've seen it even with the Joe Gallagher camp a few years ago, when he was winning awards for fun. That mentality can really feed into the rest of the fighters in that gym. And I bet Eddie Reynoso will, I bet his phone is quite busy with fighters wanting to join in the fun.
Yeah, I'd say so. Of course, we've got Herring against Frampton delayed. That fight will be for the WBO. Winner of that one might be easy to make against Valdez. You've got Jojo Diaz, who drew for the IBF title, didn't he, last time out. If he stays at the weight, he's with MTK. I suspect that's a fight they could make. Gervonta Davis immediately had a swipe at Valdez and threw his hat into the ring as well, although he's with Showtime, so I don't know if that fight can be made. But I don't think Valdez is going to be short on options.
No, I mean, I'm kind of looking at the various sanctioning body rankings now, and you've got that. You have now got, between super featherweight and lightweight, you have got a really, really enticing bunch of fighters there, haven't you, to go at. And I think that you look at the Herring and Carl Frampton fight, the winner of that going into a unification with Valdez, whoever it is, would be an interesting one. But you've got Shakur Stevenson as well, kind of waiting for his shot. So does Shakur Stevenson, you know, if that could possibly be made, that again is Stevenson and Valdez, the clash of styles there, I think it would be a fascinating one. But then we could potentially come back to the conversation that we had at the very start. Has Stevenson got enough experience in the locker to go in with someone like Oscar Valdez? But yeah, when you're in a division and you can mix and match like this, and I haven't even mentioned Gervonta Davis. I know you did. I mean, I know he's got a few little legal wrangles, shall we say, to sort out in the outside real world. But you mix all these fighters up and you pluck out two names, and that's a good fight. That's a good fight. That's a good fight. Then that is a special division. Throw in the lightweights as well, and wow, yeah, we could be set for a special time down there.
And I would be surprised if lightweight isn't where Miguel Burchelt is headed. He looks so full in the face, doesn't he? Out of fight time, and then once he weighs in as well. I mean, he doesn't look like a super featherweight by any stretch. He's absolutely enormous. And one thing that struck me after that fight, both through it and afterwards, Matt, was as good as Valdez was and as sharp and explosive as he was, Burchelt was so slow. He looked like he was wading through water or treacle. He was so slow. And that was exaggerated by how quick Valdez is. So you have to feel his days at super featherweight are numbered. So that was last weekend, of course. Gym mate to Valdez, Canelo. He's back for the second time in his just a matter of months at the Miami Hard Rock Stadium. That's on Saturday. He takes on Avnan Yildirim, who's been out of the ring 2 years since he was last stopped late on by Anthony Durrell. So out of the frying pan, into the fire, Matt. As we said, I've got no problem with Canelo taking another quick fight just to stay busy, and a fight like this, which, well, unquestionably looks a bit of a mismatch.
Oh, it's a whopping great dirty mismatch, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, because we can look at the bigger picture, we can forgive it. And I think ultimately, after being conditioned for so long for the sport's leading stars to fight just once or twice a year, that Canelo seems set on fighting perhaps four times this year and cleaning up a division as he goes, then you have to welcome that. I think that, you know, the cynic in me would be a little dubious about the fact that he has to take this fight against Yildirim because he's a WBC mandatory. If you're really trying to tell me that the WBC would have turned around and stripped the most marketable fighter on the planet for not defending against Avner Yildirim, then I'd maybe have a little discussion about that. But on paper, he can say he's ticking off a box. Yes, I'm getting rid of my mandatory. Get Avner Yildirim out the way. And then I go on to bigger and better things. And I think ultimately we have to champion the fact that the sport's leading star is fighting again in February. Now, he was only on the front cover of Boxing News in December, and he's back again already. And I don't remember, and I'm sure there has been an occasion, but I don't remember in the 11 years that I've been at Boxing News that there's been that quick a turnaround from someone the level and stature of Canelo Alvarez. I mean, pat on the back for that, but not necessarily any pats on the back to the WBC for making Avner Yildirim there mandatory. But it's a fight that, if you kind of, from the outside looking in, it makes sense. It was easy to make. And then on we go to the more intriguing and better fights later on in the year.
Indeed, indeed. On the undercard, proper fight. Julio Cesar Martinez up against McWilliams Arroyo. That's for the WBC a flyweight title, defended for the third time by Martinez. He's getting better and better, of course, that the guy was in with Charlie Edwards. And McWilliams Arroyo at both fly and super fly. He's been in with some of the best. He beat Cuadras and he's lost to Chocolatito Gonzalez and Ioka, who's improved. It was in that Japanese fight, that terrific one on New Year's Eve, wasn't he? A few months back as well. So that's going to be a really interesting one. That's a test just of how much Martinez has come forward. Hard-hitting Martinez, of course, gave Jay Harris a torrid time. Harris, I think, time will tell, did so well to see out the 12 rounds on that occasion. This will be a test of just how far he's come and how much he has or hasn't improved against Arroyo. That's on the undercard. Down under, Joseph Parker returns against Junior Farr as well, unbeaten Junior Farr in an all New Zealand affair as well. So we'll reflect on all of that in next week's show. Time now, though, for this week. And this week, we take you back to the 25th of February, 1989, to the Hilton, Las Vegas, and Mike Tyson, Frank Bruno, won. Yes, Mike Tyson, 35-0, 31 knockouts coming into this one. What was it, 3 years after he'd sparked Berbick, and about a year away from the Buster Douglas shock that shook the world. And Frank Bruno came into this with 31 knockouts and 32 victories. Hadn't he? He'd just beaten Joe Bugner. And before that, he had lost to Tim Witherspoon in his first world title challenge. And he'd lost to Bone Crusher Smith late on in that one in 84 as well. So just the two defeats, second world title tilt for Frank Bruno. And Mike Tyson, I think he'd been on a spending spree over the course of the last year, spending more time buying himself clothes than he might have been in the gym, Matt. Jim Lampley on HBO says it had been 242 days since Mike Tyson had been in the ring, that one-round demolition of Michael Spinks. 242 momentous, eventful days, said Lampley.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he'd spent a fair bit of money on drink and drugs, as he'd be the first to admit as well. He kind of was, somewhat infamously at the time, kind of going off the rails at that point in time. The fight with Bruno had been postponed. I think that Tyson had injured his hand, but both in a, he'd injured himself in a car crash, I think, where he slammed his car into a tree. He'd injured his hand on the face of Mitch Green in a street brawl. But it still seemed like a ginormous ask for Frank Bruno. And I listened to this on the radio. I was 11 years old at the time, and I listened to this on the radio, and I'd bought a Mike Tyson versus Frank Bruno kind of, some of those things that you see in the news agents at the time, and the set and the spread in the middle was score the fight yourself. So then, I'm scoring it from the radio, from the radio commentary. And after four rounds, Bruno was running away with it, I tell you. But I remember after the fight. Now, I remember after the fight, and I think it was KO magazine. I used to love KO magazine in America, and their headline afterwards was, "The Bruno fight proves that Mike Tyson can be beaten." And there was just the odd little hint in there. But then just what Harry Mullen said. Now, anybody that knows Boxing News will, of course, know Harry Mullen, without question, the greatest ever editor of Boxing News. And he kind of put things in perspective a little bit. He said, "Bruno's defiant resistance and surprising resilience will deservedly be the abiding memory of the fight, but must not be allowed to grow in telling to the point where, thanks to the peculiarly British gift for turning glorious defeat into something like victory, it will become the night when, after a near century of failure, we almost found a world heavyweight champion." And it's so true, because if you look back at that fight, now the famous bit where Harry Carpenter is "get in there, Frank" at the end, yeah, is that apart from those few seconds, Mike Tyson was on top pretty much throughout.
Yeah, I was just about to come to that, the "get in there, Frank," which I think Harry Carpenter regretted afterwards for being so, well, obviously, so being so partisan. And of course, the story of Bruno's build-up, particularly through the early part of his career, was that on-screen interview relationship with himself and Harry Carpenter. And like you, I remember listening to that on the radio at the time. That the first round is just absolute mayhem, isn't it? Bruno down in a matter of seconds. He has a go, rocks Tyson, it seems, with that left hook as well. And I actually watched the second fight over the course of the last few days as well. And I think Bruno, through the first two fights, he did spend most of the fight with his left glove cupped around the head of Tyson, didn't he? Both those fights, sort of holding him and trying to hit him. And then he had a very deliberate tactic where he would hit on the break with the left hook. And a really, really effective tactic, but not effective enough. And Tyson eventually winning that in relatively quick time, not as quick as the rematch a few years down the line. What was that? 7 years later in round three, he beat Bruno, and it would be 95, 96. He came back from 4 years out of the ring after he'd been in jail as well. 96 it was, Holyfield, and it was 1995 that Bruno finally, the fourth attempt, would get his hands on the WBC world title. His reward for that, of course, first defence against Mike Tyson. Thanks very much. So that's this week in history. At Vegas, 1989, at Tyson against Bruno. Go watch and enjoy. Time now for our book of the week. And this week it's my turn. And my selection is, I think, a must read for most boxing fans who will have idolised and read about and watched Muhammad Ali in various ways and various platforms, and probably have seen every interview, every fight, and read most of the books that are available. But this one, I think, should be compulsive reading, because it is a different book. It's called Ghosts of Manila by Mark Cram. It says Ghosts of Manila, and the sort of subtitle is The Fateful Blood Feud Between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. And it's just, I think in life, Matt, it's too easy just to read and see things that chime with our own feelings or chime with our own views. And this is a book that will jar against almost everything you've ever been told about Muhammad Ali. And I think because of that, it's an important book. And because of that, it's an interesting book. And for me, because of that, in the interest of objectivity and searching for truth and honesty and different views and opinions, I think this is a really, really interesting book. Neither of them, Joe Fraser or Muhammad Ali, at various times come out particularly well in this book because it explores different facets of their character, different things that they went through in their lives, and of course, the way that that linked and bonded the two of them together, as well as the way that their fights unfolded. So it's an intriguing book, and I think it's an important piece of work, and I think it's a must read.
I may have missed it because I was kind of looking over at my bookcase, but have you actually said what book you're talking about yet?
Yes.
Yeah, you have. Okay. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I like about this is you've summed it up there. You've summed it up there in terms of it kind of humanizes Ali, doesn't it? One of the things to read if you haven't already, or even before you get started on it, the version that I've actually found here is the author's note is at the back, and it's only probably, looking at it, I would say about 400 words long. But he just explains, you know, where the inspiration came from and what he used as evidence, etc., etc. And he just says, I just use basically my own observations, analysis, and long relationship with the principles of this story, Ali and Fraser. He also goes on to say that most of the books that have been written since, or been written about them, largely veer away from reality. He takes a swipe at the Muhammad Ali that was kind of dressed up as a bit of a biography at the time, called The Greatest 1975, and he takes a swipe at that. And this really is, if you have read lots and lots of Muhammad Ali books, this one almost comes as a bit of a shock. And I think, as the Irish Independent say, it's an exceptionally brave book. It's brilliant. If you haven't read it, look out for it. And while we're on Mark Cram, his Smoking Joe, The Life of Joe Fraser, that's another brilliant, brilliant bit of work.
Save that for another day. Mark Cram, who was with Sports Illustrated once upon a time. I'll just read you a couple of lines, because the book starts when he goes to meet Ali, I think about 8 years on since the last time he'd seen him, and after, of course, the thriller in Manila. And it's just to give you an idea of how some of it is beautifully written. He says of Ali that when he looked at his face, only his face remained as I remembered it. It was betrayed only, though, by his eyes, his words. Where once his eyes publicly spilled with tumbling clowns, they were now a dance hall at daybreak. There's a really beautiful line about how Ali looked. And there's a couple of points, just to give you an idea of how sort of forceful he is about some of the rhetoric and some of the ideology of Ali. He says, Ali was no more a social force than Frank Sinatra. He says also those that sort of idolised Ali and the literati particularly. He says what was laughable, if you knew anything about Ali at all, was that the literati was certain that he was a serious voice, that he knew what he was doing. He didn't have a clue. And there's a great line also about he was friends with, you know, he often used to have guests. Clint Eastwood and Orson Welles, it says, were regular visitors to his home. And he says, Welles appealed to Ali less as a film colossus than as a hammy fat man with a bag of magic tricks. And there's just lots of really straight to the point simplifying of Ali and what he was, what people thought he was, what he really was, and getting to the heart of some of it. Now, obviously, I've just read you some examples of that. there's lots of positive reinforcement in there as well. It's just a very, very honest piece of work. And I recommend, whether you're an Ali fan or not, and most of us are, that you go and read that in the interest of balance. That's the Ghosts of Manila, or Ghosts of Manila, by Mark Cram. A really interesting book, and we'll put that up on the notes, as ever, each and every week. Before we finish, Matt, just want to say thank you to some people who've been rating and reviewing on iTunes. Sharky FC, Bez77, Jones Champ, the W3AS3L, RJC90, Necroscope01, HDQD, and there's more on that, Prince Pete, Box Fighter Fulham, Paul, and Coming Your Irons 1895, all giving us the 5 stars, all rating and reviewing courtesy of iTunes. Thank you so much for that, and please, please go and do likewise. And as ever, you can get in touch with us on anything we've said, just a point that's on your mind, and we'll try and get to some of the emails you've sent in and are about to send in. That is theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com. Time now for Matt to prepare for the puppy.
Do you know what? I am as prepared, I think, as I will ever be. We've got. So I kind of grew up with dogs on my dad's side. Didn't live with my dad, but whenever I would go and see my dad, he would have more dogs than was sensible, to be perfectly honest. So kind of grew up with them. I've always kind of been the go-to person for friends with that have got dogs to look after them. And I have been listening to, in the spare time that I've had, I've been listening to podcasts, I've been reading up on this. So I think all that's left to do now is to do one last check around the house from puppy eye view and just go around on my hands and knees and just have a look at all the little things that he's going to be attracted to. And once I've done that, I'm as ready as I'm ever going to be. Let me on that roller coaster, I'm ready to fly.
Many suspect the yield room's going to have a puppy eye view of Canelo's shins at the weekend, don't they? That's what the betting says. We'll reflect on whether or not that actually comes to bear in this ridiculous, amazing, extraordinary sport. We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.